Welcome to lectionary lunch from Concordia Seminary. I'm Reed Lessing. I'll be leading us through the text from Isaiah chapter 51, verses 4 through 6. So, without any further ado, we would certainly make a couple of introductory comments in terms of where we're at in the book of Isaiah. At a broader level, we're at chapters 40 through 55, which most consider its own unit. More specifically, we're in the second part of that section that begins in chapter 49 and runs through chapter 54, with chapter 55 being a epilogue to all of this. So, what we will find in our study is that many of the themes in our text have been articulated earlier in chapters 40 through 50. So, without any further ado, let's at least read the first several verses, first three verses, just to get a little running head start. Listen, Shema to me, the ones pursuing Zedek. So Zedek is just the masculine noun, Zedekah is the feminine noun. So that's going to be an important motif in our specific text. But in chapter 48, essentially, Isaiah addresses the idolaters within the exilic community in Babylon. Here, he's apparently saying there is a remnant of believers, and they are pursuing Yahweh. So to pursue Yahweh is to seek righteousness. Look to the rock from which you've been cut. Literally, the chiseled out hole from which you were cut or carved out. So what's the hole in the rock? It would be Abraham, our father, and Sarah, the one who bore you. Sarah only comes here in the Old Testament outside of the book of Genesis. So this is kind of a cameo appearance. The idea is that Yahweh started with just Abraham and Sarah. Indeed, one, he called him, and he blessed him, and he multiplied him. The idea is that Yahweh did it once, he can do it again. And it's probably important that Avram and Sarai had Ur and then Haran as their points of departure, especially Ur, which is exactly where the captives in Babylon are, who are receiving this. So, God did it once in Babylon, he can do it again. So Yahweh, verse 3, is comforting Zion, and this comfort is more than just words, because he's nakaming all of Zion's waste places, desolate places, dry places. So the comfort that begins chapter 40 and through 55, chapter 40, verse 1, this comfort, as I said, is more than words. It's a comfort of restoration, because he's comforting the ruins he's placing in her wilderness, like Eden, and her Arabah, her wasted places like the Garden of Yahweh. Rejoice, and or joy and gladness will be found in her, thanksgiving and the voice of music with a instrument. So that kind of brings us to our text. Verse 4, hearken to me, my people. So hearken what? Are these great gospel promises, beginning with Abraham and Sarah, and now the promise of Eden-like restoration. So who wouldn't want to hearken and listen to this? Me, my people, that certainly takes us back to 40 verse 1, comfort, comfort my people. And The next word is fairly rare. It's only used here in a singular form in the Old Testament. It's normally le'umim, meaning peoples. Here it's, and my people to me, ha'azinu. Both of these verbs, hakshivu and ha'azinu, are hifil imperatives, masculine plural. And you have a nice kind of chiasm here, A, B, B, A. Hearken, then my people, well, a lie to me, and then my people to me, extend your ear. Ozen would be the nominal form of the verb, which is the word that means ear. So, lend an ear. Ki Torah me iti teitze. So Torah from me. Now earlier in chapter 2, Torah is going out from Zion. Here it's coming out from Yahweh. And my mishpat as a light for peoples. Well, here, you know, Torah and mishpat are obviously in a parallel sequence. And so mishpat here is not justice or judgment. It's more of a vindication. The vindication for Yahweh's people in Babylon is coming forth. That's the Torah. That's the revelation. The people in chapter 40, verse 27, were lamenting, that's Jacob Israel, saying that Yahweh's passed over their mishpat, that he's forgotten their vindication. Well, not so. Here it is. It's a light for the peoples. Apparently, if we, you know, try to understand this last word of verse 4, our gi'ah, this hifil from ragah, means something like to bring rest. Rest from the exile in Babylon. So, verse 5, karov tzidki. So here we have, you know, our word zedek again. People are pursuing it in verse 1. Now it is near. Now the question is, do you take this karov, this adjective, temporally or kind of personally? It's probably a double entendre. So my righteousness is near, chronologically speaking. He's about to bring the exiles out of Babylon, 538 BC, Cyrus's decree. But also it's near in a personal way. Yahweh is their karov one. 19 times in Isaiah 40:55, Yahweh is called Israel's Goel, kinsman restorer. So it's kind of hard to understand how to take this karov. So anyway, Yahweh himself is their righteousness. See, my righteousness is myself. I'm the near one. Or near temporally is my righteousness. So either way, maybe the first, you know, the chronological sense makes the most sense here in verse 5. So my righteousness is near. If you do it as a person, though, then the righteousness comes from chapter 53, verse 11, reads, after the turmoil of his life, he will see, he will be satisfied by his knowledge. But what we're after is here, Yatzdik tzadik avdi la rabim. So my righteous servant will justify many. Then you have the last line in 54, verse 17. This is the inheritance of the Avdei Yahweh. Their righteousness is from me. without going, you know, too far afield here, any sermon on using righteousness, which is the main, you know, word here, at least in verse 1, chapter 51 and verse 5. The righteousness is near because of a righteous servant who justifies many. And we know that the righteous servant, the punishment that brought us peace was upon him, by his wounds were healed, etc. So that's near, I guess, in three ways. Chronologically, by means of Cyrus's decree. Personally, by means of Yahweh being Israel's near kinsman redeemer. By the way, Karov is used in a parallel form with Goel, kinsman restore redeemer, in the book of Ruth. So it's not just kind of making things up. So you've got Karov chronologically, you've got it personally, and you have it near textually. Because we get the full-blown righteous vindicating work of the servant that then restores the servants of Yahweh, the exiles. This is their inheritance, 54:17. Again, righteousness here is understood as a gospel idea. Yetzah Yeshi, my salvation, my victory is coming forth. And here we have, this is interesting, Uzeroi. So this is either a dual or a plural. My arms, Yamim Yishpotu, my arms, people's will, not see judge here, Shafat, but here, I mean, it could mean that in some texts, but here, vindicate. So my arms will vindicate Amim, people. Now, this is the only time you have plural arms in 40 to 55. So it's probably an intensive plural is how most people take it. My mighty arm, see, will vindicate peoples. Now, the arm of Yahweh, this is an Exodus motif. It's an outstretched arm that we have throughout the book of Exodus and then recalled in the book of Deuteronomy, just kind of ad infinitum. Yahweh's arm is an Exodus motif. And one could argue that the arm, and here mighty arm, is the glue that holds 40 to 55 together. If you go to chapter 40, verse 9, the evangelist Zion has a two-word sermon, and it is simply this at the end of verse 9. Say to the cities of Judah, Hine Elohim, behold your God. Well, so look at your God. Well, who is this God? In verse 10, he has an arm, Zeruach Moshelelo, ruling for him. In verse 11, he has an arm who's gathering. So this is the best of the best. Yahweh's arm is powerful, verse 10. It is tender like a shepherd in verse 11. We sing this in Holy, Holy, Holy. He's merciful and mighty, right? Mighty in verse 10, merciful in verse 11. He's tender and tough. He's soft and sovereign. You need both. If he's all-powerful, he doesn't give a rip about you. If he's all-loving, he doesn't have the power to enact his love. So this motif of arm comes in 52:10. Yahweh will lay bare, Zeruah code show, his holy arm. There's the mighty arm, see, the strong arm of 40 verse 10. But in 53:1, who has believed our report, Uzeroach Yahweh, and the arm of Yahweh, upon who has revealed it. So there's the compassionate arm of 40 verse 11, the tender shepherding arm, the arm that finally is going to hang limp on a Roman instrument of death. So it's this mighty arm that is, again, both merciful and mighty that we have here in 51 verse 5. And again, it's an intensive plural. My mighty arm will vindicate people. Well, there's a sermon right there. Go back to Exodus, go back to 40:10-11, go forward to 52:10 and 53:1, and you got it. You got it. So when Yahweh lays bare his holy arm, it's like he's on steroids, but it's really natural stuff. Bulging biceps, right? He's got tattoos on his bicep, but he's also got blood on it in chapter 53:1. Okay, so to me, Iyim, islands, so these would be, not the Yisrael or Yaakov, see, not my people, that we have in verse 4, but this would be Gentiles, okay? They will hope, they will trust, and to my arm, there it is, singular, they will Yakal, same idea of kavah, trust, hope, have confidence in. So this servant, finally, if we go to chapter 53, this servant is not only for my people Israel, he's for the Iyim, he's for the coastlands, the islands, the nations. And then you get into 49 verse 6, where you have that exactly, that he is a light to the nations. And Simeon says then in Luke chapter 2, the glory of his people Israel. Okay, so then we go to verse 6. Lift up, so in light of this permanence, right, this guaranteed righteousness that comes through the mighty arm of Yahweh's servant, don't trust in the heavens. Now, so here, my heavens, the heavens. This would be Babylonian astrology and astronomy. Of course, in antiquity, they didn't differentiate between the two. So, look at the heavens, see. Gaze to the earth underneath. So, this is a nice Hebrew merism. Look at the heavens, look at the earth. Look at everything in between, right? And in light of this gospel salvation, the heavens will disappear ke'ashan, like smoke, and the earth like a garment, ke'beged, will wear out, and its inhabitants will be, now this is interesting, kemo kain, like thus, okay? Well, what does that mean? So there's kind of a flag on the play. So we go down, and we can see that this Kamo Cain, the editors have LC Lectio Cum read with Qumran B, and Qumran B, which is not Qumran A. That's the whole enchilada of the book of Isaiah. Qumran B is chapters 41 through 66. They apparently have the word for locusts. Many interpreters simply want to add a mame, and then on Cain, so you have kaf, nun, mame, and then you have something like gnats or flies or fleas. And I think that's the way a lot of English versions take it. So all its inhabitants, that would be the world's inhabitants, are like fleas or gnats, see, yemutun, they will die. It has probably got to be amended to make some sense, because its inhabitants like thus they will die, probably like fleas or gnats. In chapter 40, verse 22, Isaiah says, the one is sitting upon the circle of the earth, its inhabitants, see, same word, veyo sheveha, okay, its inhabitants, kako kavim, are like the grasshoppers. So that might give us some interpretive momentum to amend the text to be fleas or gnats or flies. So whatever they are, the inhabitants of the earth, they're grasshoppers, they're fleas, they're flies, they're transitory. They're here today and gone tomorrow. Thus they will die. So don't pay any attention to the inhabitants of the earth. If we kind of go back to chapter 40, see, the inhabitants of the earth would be in verse 23, the Rogazim and the Shofetei Eretz. So this is probably what's going on here. It's not just any old inhabitants of the earth. The Rogazim would be the potentates, and then the Shofetei Eretz would be the rulers of the earth. See, Babylon, that's what you have to see here. The Babylonian, the kings and the princes and the potentates and the monarchs. See, the government authorities that say they control everything. Those guys are what? They are like flies. They will die. See, so don't put your trust in Babylonian pomp and circumstance. Put your trust in my arm, my mighty arm. It saves not only you, but the islands and coastlands. Okay, and then we have what? Just a beautiful promise. Vishui le'olam tihya. My salvation will be olam. See, now, just since there's no one here and it's just Bill Wilson and I, we're going to just keep talking. But see, it's interesting. Go to chapter 47, verse 7. See, Babylon has its claim too. You see, 47:7, and she says, Le'olam ehyeh. Ho, I will be forever. See, that's what Babylon offers. You need a New Testament idea of Babylon. Look at 1 Peter, especially at the end of chapter 5, I think verse 13. She who is from Babylon greets you. So we're strangers and pilgrims in our modern day Babylon. And Babylon continues to say, Le'olam ehyeh. But Yahweh counters and says, Vishui le'olam tihya. See, it's my salvation that's forever. Because Yahweh is the everlasting God. And we have that in chapter 40, verse 28. Elohe olam Yahweh. His word endures forever. He's endures forever. His salvation is forever. His chesed is forever. We get that in chapter 54. And then we have, my righteousness will not fail. Vetzid kati lo tekat. Well, that's kind of where it ends. Hopefully there's enough there to maybe get a sermon out of, and we don't have a New Testamentaler here yet. What is the gospel lesson?
It's Mark chapter 13.
Okay, well, we'll just start on Mark chapter 13. I've got a class at 12:30, so I have to start eating, but I don't mind eating and talking on Mark's Olivet Discourse. Mark 13, what?
24.
Okay, well, here we go. So Mark 13:24, again, the Olivet Discourse, I think we're all familiar with that in Matthew chapter 24 and Luke 21. And here would be the synoptic version for Mark. Okay, so we're talking about the end of Jerusalem in 70 A.D., and like a good Old Testament prophet, Jesus combines the end of Jerusalem with the end of the world. So they're kind of telescoped into one event, although there are times in the Olivet Discourse you can kind of separate the two. But in those days, so what days? See, in the days of Titus, the Roman general who later became the emperor after his successful crushing of the Jews and the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. But in those days, after this Philippian tribulation, Philippo means to squeeze, so you're getting kind of squeezed. After this tribulation, again, the 70 AD tribulation and the tribulation of, you know, being a believer in the last days, the sun will be darkened, right? Was that a future passive of scoptizo? Future passive indicative third singular. And certainly these are Old Testament ideas from Isaiah, Joel. I'm just looking at my marginal notes. And the moon will not give udozeh from didomeh, right? So it's another future idea. This one would be a future indicative active third singular. The moon will not give its phelgos, would be like its light, its effulgence. So this pairs nicely with what Isaiah is saying, that the, I've got that opened, that the heavens will wear out like smoke and the earth will vanish like a garment. Here it's the sun and the moon, the heavenly bodies. Verse 25, the stars, future from Emeh, will be in the heavens, Piptontos, from Pipto, which means to fall. So the stars will be in the heavens falling. And the powers, you know, the high dynamis, now those powers in the heavens are probably the planets or something like that. And they will be shaken, okay? Future passive indicative third singular from Saluo, which is a major motif, beginning with Amos of all people. Amos 1, verse 1, last two words, 2 years before the earthquake. So the earthquake vindicated Amos's ministry. Earthquake vindicates several other prophets' ministries. It certainly vindicates Jesus' ministry, not in Mark, but in Matthew. There's an earthquake at his death. There's an earthquake at his resurrection. So we need to understand earthquake here, shaking, in terms of God's visitation and his eschatological deliverance that has begun in Jesus, but is yet to be fulfilled. Certainly Haggai chapter 2 talks a lot about shaking, and the Hebrew writer picks that up at the end of chapter 12. So there's a whole lot of shaking going on. Okay, and when this happens, again, another future from Orao, they will see. So who's the they? Apparently, you know, the inhabitants of the world, they will see the Son of Man. This is the Danielian Son of Man, not the Ezekielan Son of Man. Ezekiel Son of Man means mortal. Daniel, son of man, is equivalent to the Ancient of Days. He's full-blown deity. Coming in the clouds, well, that's how Yahweh comes, right? Beginning in Exodus chapter 19, Psalm 18, he rides the chariots on the clouds. And the New Testament is quick to pick this up because Jesus' ministry, in a sense, is defined by the clouds. His baptism, transfiguration, his ascension, here his second coming. We all have, all these texts have clouds to indicate that this is the Creator coming to redeem and judge his creation. With great power and glory is how it comes. And then he will send, so here's another future from Apostello, right? His angels, his messengers, and they will gather the tus electus, our two. His elect. So, 2 Timothy 2 verse 10 says, you do anything for the sake of the elect. You die for them, you bleed for them, you're risen for them, and then you come for them and you gather them. And these are what? From the four winds, from the corner of the earth and unto heaven. So we don't have to worry where you are at this point. You know, wherever you're at, the angels are going to come and gather you. Verse 28. So now we shift gears. Because Jesus wants to teach a parable. So from the fig tree, the suitcase, learn. Aorist imperative, active second person, plural from Montano. Learn the parable. When already its branches, now here I'm a little bit guessing, its branches are become new, and, oh, that's probably not it. The branches become ripe, and the phyla would be there. The leaves are there. That's the idea. So when the branches are full born, and leaves are there, you know that Angus ta theros estin. You know that the harvest is near. Therefore, even you, when you see, there's a subjunctive aorist indicative second singular from orao, ideta. When you see these things happening, ginomai, know, another imperative, aorist imperative, that Angus estin Epi theorize. Know that he is near upon the door. Is that right? Theorize. I think that's it. That he's near upon the door. How far do we keep going?
37.
Oh, ma'am. Okay.
He's at the gate.
Amen, I say to you, this generation will not pass away. See, now we're going, as I said at the beginning, we kind of began at the last day, right, with the heavenly bodies changing, etc., the Son of Man coming with great power and glory in the clouds. But now Jesus is switching back to the 70 AD day, which is a down payment of the final day. So, amen, I say to you, that this generation will not pass away until all these things happen. See? Well, here, again, we have to understand that we're not premillennial dispensationalists. Who would interpret the fig tree, see, as the modern state of Israel, and now that it's there, and it's kind of ripe, then these things are going to take place. So they would understand verse 30, this generation, to be like our generation, right? The post May 6, 1948 generation. But if you're listening to this, you know that's not the way we interpret the Bible. So Jesus is going back now to 70 AD, not 2009. This generation will not pass away. Heaven and earth will pass away, right? My words will never pass away. Concerning these days, see now what days? The 70 AD days and the last days, see, or the hour, no one knows. Neither the angels in heaven, neither the Son, you know, Emmet is except the Father. So someone says, I know, they don't know. Watch, we have these imperatives here. Watch, be alert, for you don't know when the Kairos is. Another parable. As a man leaves on a journey to his house, or from his house, and gives, deuce, it says, eris participle from didomia, gives his servants the authority, each one his work, and the thuroo, that would be probably like the main guy in charge, the steward, he commands in order to watch. Watch, so there's a little mini parable. Watch, therefore, because you do not know when the Lord of the house is coming. This happens very frequently in Jesus' parables. It starts out as an anthropos in verse 34, but in verse 35, oh, by the way, it's the hakurios. Not just any old man. When you see, okay, let's go back. Verse 35. Be alert, awake then, for you do not know when Lord of the house comes, whether evening or the middle of the night, or when the rooster crows, or pro-e early. Not coming suddenly, he will find you sleeping. So, what's that mean? He's coming suddenly, may he not find you sleeping. For to you, I have said all these things. I'm saying all these things. Be alert. Well, okay. There you have it. We got 93% of the words. But I hope this is helpful for those of you listening.